Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the A10 Talk podcast. I'm Sam Basil, joined today by David Korn, as well as Riley Frayne from Mid-Major Madness. Riley, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Sam. David, thank you so much for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it. Of course, love all the work you guys are doing here, and just excited for the opportunity. It's been a couple crazy days in Brooklyn at the Barclays Center. We got a lot to recap for sure.
I think crazy is the right word to describe it, Riley. I mean, Sam, just take it away with what exactly happened in the quarterfinal.
Yeah, so, anybody listening, if you don't know yet, I don't know where you've been, but, it's been talked about a lot these past, as of recording these past 18-ish hours, historic quarterfinals in the 2024 Atlantic 10 Championship. All four double bye teams were taken down by teams that, entered in the second round. We're going to get into how that happened for each team, how that kind of happened in general, with some, thoughts from Mark Schmidt about, the philosophy of rest versus momentum and all those kinds of things that people always, love to debate in terms of conference tournaments, in terms of the NCAA tournament. And we'll see, how this year's Atlantic 10 tournament is kind of, a real example of what it takes to, kind of emerge as a champion in a conference as tough as the Atlantic 10. So let's start off with the first game of the day, which was the St. Joe's Hawks taking down the number one seed Richmond Spiders. To me, I mean, you guys might, have some disagreements here, but it felt like the Richmond Spiders played 30 really good minutes of basketball. There was a point where Neil Quinn hit two shots to put the Spiders up 10, but all throughout, I think the underlying issue was that they could not find a way to stop Eric Reynolds. He finished the day with 30 points, and he, he was constantly getting these buckets here and there to keep St. Joe's just out of, just in contention and just give them enough juice to not let the Spiders completely run away. And then towards the end there, it got pretty physical. Cameron Brown got some really good buckets. He had a really good and one. And then St. Joe's ended up pulling away for the 5-point win. Riley, I know you're one of the bigger St. Joe's fans, covering the tournament out there right now. Could you break down what you saw from your Hawks and how they're able to pull this one out?
Yeah, I mean, I think you got to take a look at the first half first. It was definitely coming out a bit of a slow start. I know Richmond, I think they started out the game on a 7-0 run, and St. Joe's quickly kind of able to pull it back. But I mean, you look at the halftime score, Richmond ahead 24-22. I think, you said it, Sam, Richmond played some solid basketball for 35 minutes almost throughout this contest, kind of highlighted by Neil Quinn's dominance on the floor. St. Joe's didn't have a lot of answers for them, but I think it really starts with the defensive effort on everyone outside of Eric Reynolds. I mean, you mentioned it at the top of the discussion for this game. Eric Reynolds was the leading man. He effectively carried St. Joe's to this win with 30 points. And you don't get a lot of contributions from guys outside of Cam Brown being the only other scorer in double digits. But when it came down to it at the end, Rashear Fleming, Lynn Greer hitting some clutch free throws to carry St. Joe's through. And a couple important rebounds as well from Rashear, if I do recall correctly. So again, you look back at the first half, a slow start for Richmond, perhaps that hurts them, with how dominant they were in the first half. And St. Joe's able to hang on just enough, like you said, Sam, pulling away in the second half, 66-61 behind. Eric Reynolds really is the main man. And I said it to Aaron Brakey of BigFiveHoops.com yesterday. Eric Reynolds, I think it was midway through the first half, I said, St. Joe's is not going to win this game if Eric Reynolds doesn't have at least 30 points. And I mean, look at that. He carried them to the win yesterday. It felt like at times he was the only one on the court for St. Joe's.
Yeah, I feel like at this point where they are in the tournament, I feel like for St. Joe's to continue winning like they did against Richmond, they have an incredibly low margin of error and they really need everything to go right. And a part of that going right for them is Eric Reynolds playing at his absolute best. And I think he did that. And I think what's the most impressive thing about Eric Reynolds playing at his best is that he was clearly not 100% healthy. He had an elbow injury that John Rothstein reported would make him questionable, or I believe the exact phrasing was Billy Lang was unsure if he was going to play in the quarterfinal matchup. and it was still bothering him. It looked like he was taking a beating in that game, by the way. I think that needs to be said. Looked like he had rolled his ankle, re-aggravated that arm injury, got hit in the face, just seeking out contact at the rim through all of that. And I just thought it was so impressive how all he was sort of enduring that, and then he was able to continue making these shots, kept driving to the rim, all of that. Eric Reynolds, I was just so impressed with what I saw from him. And I'm not sure. Yes, St. Joseph's has other guys who can score. Lynn Grier, I've seen him drop 30. Cameron Brown and Xavier Brown, both very talented. Rashear Fleming has even poured in some points this tournament, but Eric Reynolds is the guy who's going to have to score. I'm not sure I have enough faith in their secondary scorers to, be able to bank on them being able to carry the load if Reynolds isn't scoring at the level he needs to be in these next two potential games. Reynolds needs to keep this up for St. Joseph's to keep winning.
Yeah, great point. It felt like Eric Reynolds, as he was approaching 30, it felt like Richmond thought that maybe there was just nothing they could do to stop him. So let's just kind of limit everybody else. Obviously, that didn't work, as Cameron Brown kind of came up clutch in the end. Where do you feel like St. Joe's depth could give them some trouble, Riley?
Yeah, I mean, you look at the bench yesterday, they only had two men coming off. There's Kreese Esendoko for 15 minutes, Kasper Kljacek for 16. The depth has not been great throughout the season as different guys have battled injuries, different guys have battled slumps, and it's been tough. I mean, there are still some guys on the bench who I think could play some important minutes, particularly against a team like VCU. You look at someone maybe like an Ant Finkley who hasn't played a ton of minutes. I'm as far as I know, he's healthy. He's a bigger guy who can hold down the interior a little bit and could still, guard some of the smaller guards that VCU tends to have throughout their roster. So I think depth is definitely going to be a big question, particularly, with St. Joe's having played. I know we'll get into the conversation of kind of rest versus actually being out there on the court getting game action. But this St. Joe's team undoubtedly has played a lot of minutes, is not the deepest, and that's going to pose some problems, definitely, heading into the later rounds here.
I feel like I'd be surprised if they do go any deeper than they have gone at this point, because you'd feel like maybe the George Mason game would be a time when they test that depth, not the semifinal against BCU. So I'd be really surprised if they go farther. I think at this point you have to ride or die with your guys. They know that they're gonna have to play big minutes, and if you're Billy Lang, I think you have a really tough time looking Eric Reynolds or even Xavier Brown at this point, looking at them and telling them to come out of this game for a guy who hasn't played in this tournament. They're going to need to be out there for St. Joe's to win.
Yeah, absolutely, David. I couldn't agree more. I mean, you look at the minute shares from yesterday, and I think it speaks to pretty much everything you just said. The three main guards in X can in X Lynn and Eric all out there for almost 30 minutes. Lynn only played, it looks like, 22. But on top of that, Cameron Brown put almost playing essentially a full 40. And so just again, that speaks to kind of the lack of depth they have on the bench, and that's definitely gonna, hurt them here in the later rounds with having to play over the past 2 days. I know we get the bye here on Friday, but having to play in the last 2 days of the tournament in general.
Richmond leaves this tournament as the co-regular season champions of the A10. Obviously, this year they don't do the automatic spots for regular season champions in the NIT anymore, but the vibe in the press conference for Richmond generally felt like everyone thought that they have a little bit more basketball to play. Do we feel like Richmond is pretty much a lock for this NIT, and what do you think we can get out of them in a potential run?
Chris Mooney said he was very sure that they would be playing in the NIT. And I think we also saw, I forget who it was, but we just saw a high major deny their bid to the NIT. So, or not deny, I don't know if there's a bid yet, but they said that they would not be participating in the NIT. So I think that'll be something we see. So even though I do think mid-majors will still find their way in there, even without the regular season auto bid anymore. So I'm very confident with sort of what I'm seeing around college basketball and with what Mooney said, that they'll be playing in the NIT. But I think the bigger question now will be whether or not there will be any home games for them and how they will do once they get in.
Yeah, that will be very interesting to see. But until then, we got three more games to talk about that happened yesterday. Up next, in our next big upset, we had VCU taking down the four-seeded UMass Minutemen. That was a 73-59 win. Zeb Jackson, 17 points, four steals for the Rams. The game that they played the day prior was a, just the definition of grind it out, right? Against the Fordham Rams. Neither team scored a field goal in the last 6 minutes in that one. It was won almost completely at the line. VCU did not have to do it against UMass. They pretty much got out to a pretty strong lead early on and, kind of never really looked back. Initial thoughts on the Rams' hot start and how that affected them, starting off with you, Riley.
They came in, what? I'm looking at the schedule right now. Came in off the back of three losses, definitely not boding well in terms of, looking to produce in the conference tournament. You talked about grinding it out yesterday, Sam, at the foul line against, or excuse me, you talked about grinding it out Wednesday at the foul line against Fordham. I don't necessarily think that played well into the kind of matchup they had to, deal with against UMass, but certainly able to get it done. I mean, I wrote that they pretty much felt like they VCU had throttled UMass the whole way outside of a quick run kind of in the middle of the in between the first and second half there from Rasul Diggins to kind of try and will UMass back into it. But yeah, I mean, you talk about the dominance in the second half, particularly late in the second half from VCU. This is obviously a team that has a ton of depth, unlike St. Joe's, like we just talked about, has a ton of guys who can put the ball in the back in the bucket. And you mentioned the defensive effort there, Sam. I think we continue to see if BCU can limit the fouls, unlike they've done over the past couple of days, and we can continue to see that level of defensive effort from this team, they're going to give St. Joe's major problems, particularly with just their size and versatility throughout the roster.
I never really believed in UMass in a tournament setting because I think the cliche is guards win in March. And from the beginning of the season, I know I caught a lot of flack from this, especially when UMass started playing better, but I really just didn't think that UMass's guard sort of starting guard trio was up to snuff with the rest of the Atlantic 10. And I know Cohen and Cross and Diggins at times, they like he played well, but I just think one of the big things we've seen this tournament is that guards win in March. The Atlantic 10 is a guards league. And, VCU had better guard play. Max Schulga's elite. Joe Bamisol played really well off the bench. And like you mentioned, Zeb Jackson too overwhelmed them. I think it showed that cliche rings true.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to point out that despite maybe free throws not being as much of the identity of this game as that was against Fordham, VCU still shot 30. Zeb Jackson was 10 for 11 from the line. And then another guy that had, actually the high scorer of this game off the bench was Joe Bamisil. 18 points, 6 for 9 from the field, 4 for 6 from 3-point range. He has been really crucial to VCU in these last couple games, especially this week in Brooklyn. David, you've watched Bamisil. You watched him at GW. He's been in this league for a decent amount of time. Could you talk about, what you saw out of him and what his experience in the A10 has allowed him to kind of give VCU an advantage in this one?
I think he's found his perfect role at VCU as a microwave scorer off the bench. Joe Bamisil is a guy who wants the ball in his hands. He knows that he can score at a very, very high level. And he know he feels he can do that better than pretty much anyone on the court. And that can show sometimes. So I think he has a perfect role right now where he doesn't play the whole game. He comes in off the bench. He knows the ball's coming to him. He can score. And I think in this game against UMass, especially with him playing so well, he exercised some of the ghosts of the his tournament game with VCU, where he or with GW, I should say, when he was at GW 2 years ago, when GW was mounting a furious comeback against UMass in the second round, and I think they were down 12 at the time, and they were trying to come back. There were like 8 or 9 minutes left, and Bamisil thought it was a great idea to go for a contested windmill dunk. And didn't go in, and that pretty much sunk GW season. And so I'm really glad he's playing better. And I wish him nothing but the best. And it's fun to see him succeeding, and it's fun to see his high flying, high scoring style of play on this setting.
I think it's worth mentioning that. I mean, Bamisil really a lot of perseverance to come out and have such a strong performance against UMass particularly, I mean, he struggled against Fordham, just 8 points. He was 2 of 7 from the free throw line, which is just horrible. I mean, he only shot 2 for 6 from the field, grabbed 5 rebounds still. So, he was still finding other ways to contribute. But again, I just think it speaks to, BCU's ability to be perseverant, to find guys contributing, all throughout the starting lineup, not just someone like Bamisil, Scholgo, or Barristow. For him to come back, have a big performance against UMass, I think, as I know I mentioned before, but just bodes well for BCU's potential chances heading into the semifinal matchup.
Yeah, so they're going to be taking on St. Joseph's in the first semifinal of the day at 1 p.m. on Saturday, probably, the afternoon of the day that this podcast comes out. Initial thoughts on this matchup. Where do you think, either VCU or St. Joe's is going to have the advantage here? I know we mentioned St. Joe's is, kind of disadvantage at depth. How do you think that's going to play into this?
I mean, I think it's going to play a major factor. I think obviously St. Joe's has, some of the best guards in the league, but that depth is going to run St. Joe's into the ground. I mean, you have 4 or 5 guards on this, VCU roster that can potentially cause problems. You look at Scholga, Seb Jackson. I think Bamisil maybe plays more of a wing role, but he's a good scorer and someone who could potentially, run the offense as well. Of course, you got Barristow, you got Jason Nelson all the way down the roster, who's only contributing, 5.6 points per game, but is still a really effective player at times when he needs to be for VCU. And so I think St. Joe's, after essentially the whole starting lineup playing 35, 30 plus minutes the other day against Richmond, they're going to have a lot of trouble keeping up with the pace of this VCU offense, dealing with some of the size and versatility that a lot of these guys provide. Now, that being said, I think the defensive effort we've seen from St. Joe's the past couple 2 games, 3 games, even if you want to go back to the end of the regular season, has been far better than anything we saw from them during the, during A-10 play, during the in-conference stretch. So hopefully St. Joe's, looks to keep that going. And if they can keep VCU off balance and kind of control the tempo a little bit more in this game, get the ball in Eric Reynolds' hands, get contributions from, some of those guys who maybe weren't there against the Richmond game, like an X Brown, like a Lynn Greer, by not there, I mean guys who weren't contributing as much. And you get some contribution throughout the roster. I think that'll be critical to St. Joe's finding any success against such a deep VCU team with a ton of guard talent throughout the roster, as well as just a ton of versatility.
Absolutely. David, any extra factors that you feel like might play into this one tomorrow?
I agree with what Riley said. I think St. Joseph's, if they want to beat VCU, they're going to need some secondary scoring. And a guy who I'm going to look for as St. Joseph's X factor is going to be Lynn Greer, who I think could have, if I just think it's so tough to sort of put that scoring load on Reynolds' shoulders. So I think if Greer, especially, I think he's the guy who I think is a natural fit to step up that scoring load against VCU and their point guard defense, point of attack defense. So I think that if Lynn Greer's scoring at a high level, if Lynn Greer hits 20 points, St. Joseph's wins.
Let's get into our third game, which, I think all of these games were very exciting, but if you want to, if you had to pick one, I feel like this might have been the one, which was Saint Bonaventure taking down the other co regular season champs, the Loyola Chicago Ramblers, 75-74 in double overtime. The atmosphere in this game, aside from what was happening on the court, felt really fun. A huge showing from both Loyola fans and Saint Bonaventure fans. They were sitting right next to each other on that baseline that's right behind the benches. And I mean, it was electric. Sister Jean was in the house. That was really fun to see. And it just came down to a Darryl Banks drawn foul at the 3-point line, and he hit all three, giving Saint Bonaventure the victory. I asked Coach Schmidt. This was something I've mentioned. Listeners of the pod all season might honestly be kind of sick of me saying this quote, but I asked Coach Schmidt at Media Day about experience and how important that is in this conference, and he basically said it was everything. And so I followed up with him yesterday, about his experience in a game like this. It's a tough situation to find yourself in as a coach, but Coach Schmidt's been around this league for a long time. He's been around this team for a long time. And I asked him, how has experience played into getting the win here. And he just talked about this is the exact quote. As a young coach, you may panic a little bit, but when you have good players, it makes me look much better. We have a veteran team, even though they played in our system for only 1 or 2 years. All those guys have been in tough situations, pressure situations. I'm lucky to have those guys out there producing. He also made a joke about him being old and having no hair, but I didn't really feel like that was relevant to the win. But David, how do you feel like Bonnie's experience really helped them lift themselves out of this one?
I mean, I think the big story of the game is Loyola Chicago going almost over 8 minutes at the end of regulation and into overtime without scoring a basket. They were at 58 points for over 8 minutes through both periods. I just think that is unheard of. That is like actually shocking that that happened. And St. Bonaventure was able to capitalize and come back and, I mean, I just think they played a great game. They really clamped up defensively. Loyola just could not find any offense really outside of Phil Ballston in overtime and in the second half. And it's both overtime, I should say. And credit Mark Schmidt. I think he's done the coaching job of the tournament so far by going away from Chad Venning and leaning on reserve center Noel Brown, who I'm going to have a big feature on. Out on A10 Talk, hopefully by the time this podcast is out. And I just think Mark Schmidt's sort of courage in going away from his all-conference second team center and going to a guy who really has played limited minutes throughout his entire A10 career, transfer from GW, to really lean on him at this time in such a high leverage situation is, I think, the biggest call that a coach has made this tournament so far, like the biggest individual personnel call a coach has made, and the biggest success that a coach has had in a decision they've made. And I just think that deserves a ton of props with the way he's playing, the way that worked out, and Schmidt for having the stones to do it.
Yeah, Riley, that final shot from Darryl Banks, I think again experience plays into it, right? I was talking about this with Tyler Cronin of 3-Bid League, but it felt like a tough situation to put yourself in, right? Where it's the last second, and he heaved up a three-pointer that it didn't really feel like it was gonna go in anyway. But it's one of those things where you have maybe a defender who just wants to get the block, stop the game. It's a bit of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation, right? Like you let the guy take the shot and you hope that he misses, or you try to get the block and risk the foul. What do you think that says about Banks's playmaking ability to force an opponent into a situation like that?
Oh, well, I think it speaks to the whole thing we've been talking about here. He's a veteran guy on a veteran team who knows how to lead the way. I mean, Coach talked about it. Coach Schmidt talked about it post game. Just for him to go through after having such a successful season in really his first round in the A-10 last year. I don't have his averages in front of me at the moment, but I know he was a double digit scorer last year at St. Joe's. I think he was averaging something like 14, 15 points. To kind of have to take more of a step back role this year where he's not the main guy. He's got some other pieces that are going to help outside of just Chad Venning down low. The additions of Micah Adams-Woods, of course, I think is critical to this year's team. He's carried them through some important wins throughout the season. And I remember watching him at the Legends Classic at the Barclays Center as well earlier this year, where he carried St. Bonaventure to the championship in that as well, or to the championship matchup as well. So I think, again, Darryl Banks, it speaks to just how much he's grown throughout college basketball. He understood the situation. He understood, I believe, and correct me, either of you, if I'm wrong, but I believe it was Miles Rubin who ended up committing the foul just in the scramble to kind of get a man on Darryl Banks. So a young freshman, I think Banks understood the situation. He wanted the ball in his hands. He knew what it took, and it speaks to just his leadership on this St. Bonaventure team, which I know Mark Schmidt raved about in the press conference, just talking about what it took for him to persevere after maybe not having such a great season to kind of, again, be the leader in the critical moment here in Brooklyn when they needed him most. And obviously he was able to get it done at the free throw line, which again, I think just speaks to Darryl Banks, he knew what he needed to do. He knew what the moment called for. was able to get it done at the free throw line, and ultimately in double overtime, that's what sees it out for St. Bonaventure. So.
And David, Coach Schmidt today had a really interesting point about what it, about being a double bye team and, the perceived risks of being a double bye team, right? I mean, you look at all the teams that beat, the double bye teams. They were coming off a win. They had a little bit of momentum, and these double bye teams didn't play until, their last game was Saturday. Last week, and UMass even further. Their last game was like last Wednesday. So there was a lot of time just kind of sitting around. Coaches talk about not really being able to, be in a pressure game situation for a long time and how that kind of hurts. But could you talk about what Coach Schmidt said today and how he feels like it helped this team get the win?
Yeah, so I'll read you the poignant quotes, I think. He said, "I think the teams that have that bye, I think they're at a little bit of a disadvantage just playing in a bigger facility. If you can get through that first game pretty healthy, you have a little bit of an advantage because you've already played on the court. You have your sights down a little bit better, more comfortable." And then I followed up with him. I didn't ask the question that led to that. Then I followed up with him sort of about that, being like, "Can you elaborate more about why you think that you had the advantage there?" And then he says, "Yeah, you get comfortable. Like that first game for the first 5 or 10 minutes, you're a little bit nervous. We don't play for the most part in big facilities, other than some non-con games. But St. Louis is a big place. Dayton is a big place. Other than that, you're talking about 6,000 or 7,000 people who are at most day 10 games. So it's harder to shoot in arenas where there's not a great depth behind the basket. So I think the team that is able to play on the court more gets more experience. It's easier. It's not the reason why we won or the reason why the four," he made sure to air quote this, "lower seeds won, but I think there's something to it."
Yeah, that's a great quote. It's one of those things, right? It's like damned if you do, damned if you don't. If you get, if you push your team through a great regular season in the Atlantic 10, yeah, you're gifted with that double bye, but with it comes so much anxiety to perform, to kind of live up to that seeding. And as we saw this week, these top four teams, they kind of came up short. So let's get into the final game before we get into the, breakdown of the second semifinal. And that is Duquesne taking down 24th ranked in the AP poll, Dayton, 65-67. I think there's some parallels between St. Joe's and Dayton in this game. Like we said, it felt like letting Eric Reynolds, like Richmond letting Eric Reynolds stay hot throughout the entire game. It was just tough to mitigate, but it also ended up kind of hurting them in the end. For Duquesne, it felt like they let Deron Holmes really just, lead the way offensively for the Flyers. But in turn, they really limited everybody else's effectiveness from the field, from defense, and that allowed Duquesne to kind of come away with the upset win here. Deron Holmes had 24 points. The next highest scorer for Dayton was Nate Santos. He had 10, and then nobody else was in double digit scoring for the night. Riley, any initial thoughts on Duquesne kind of getting this one off?
Yeah, I mean, to your point, Sam, it felt like they made a lot of adjustments on everyone who wasn't named Deron Holmes, and they were kind of let Holmes do his thing and work it inside. I mean, I know Nate Santos had a short stretch where he started to get hot, but after that, Duquesne and Dambrot, they found a way to shut him down. And so I don't necessarily want to say that was their game plan, to just kind of let Holmes do his thing and we'll be able to outscore him, with the depth of our lineup. I mean, what did Duquesne played almost 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 11 guys last night, it looks like. So it just felt like that played into Duquesne's success because they were able to get contributions all throughout the lineup. I mean, only 16 points from Jimmy Clark, only 11 from Day Day Grant. That feels, a little low for them, but they are having almost everyone except for two guys who stepped on the floor last night contribute more than 5 points. So, in that. Because of that, they didn't really need to limit Holmes, kind of just let him do his thing. And obviously they made some great adjustments on other guys. Obviously Dambrot and his players made some great adjustments to defend some of the other Dayton guys. And ultimately, it led to a massive win.
Yeah, I actually asked Jimmy Clark last night about, like you said, Nate Santos had a really good start from the field in the first half. And then he kind of, he was he kind of got rattled in the second half because, as Jimmy Clark explained, they just really upped the physicality on him. They boxed him out. They really tried to crash the offensive glass a lot more. They tried to, just take away any second chance opportunities from him. And what they explained was, if we can wear out a guy like that, then they can focus on Daron Holmes. Daron Holmes was fouled 10 times last night. So if you can do that, if you can just kind of keep hacking away at a player and making them more and more exhausted, it's, I would say like 9 times out of 10, it's going to be really, really effective. David, any thoughts on Duquesne's, on game plan last night?
I think Duquesne has the chance. I think they are the team that can sort of play the best of the remaining teams. When everything's clicking, I think they have the best combination of sort of high potential scoring, great individual defenders, ability to play with a variety of teams, play a variety of different styles. I know something I was a little worried about was their interior defense, but the way they played against Holmes and just the way they just threw a bunch of different looks at him, fouled him, were able to limit his effectiveness. And that really made me sort of a believer in the Dukes. And I think honestly, at this point, they're kind of the team to beat, I think, going in. And, I love Day-Day Grant. I think he's a really impressive player. Jimmy Clark, I think the two of them form such a great pair in the backcourt with Clark's defense and Grant's playmaking and shot making. I think they're a really fun team. They got off to a rough start, but they are peaking at just the right time. The one thing you need to worry about, though, is forward Trey Williams, who shoulder popped out yesterday, didn't return. I believe he's questionable in day to day, but I'd be really surprised. I'd be really, really surprised if he's able to play for them again this tournament. And that'd be a big loss down low for them, so they need to figure out. But again, we talked about this. They have depth. If any team can absorb a hit, I think it's Duquesne. And I don't think that'll sink them with any of the teams left.
Yeah, I actually asked Coach Dambrot about his depth, and in his answer, he did mention Trey Williams being pretty banged up. So basically, they ran 11 deep last night, and I asked him, the importance of that in, this late in the season and in this tournament. And he just said, this is, he said, quote, "It's good to get tested again because Trey Williams is pretty banged up, but I think we can withstand quite a few things. We have a lot of guys that can do a lot of things, so we just need to play one more good game. And one more good game. That's it." And I think it really just is a testament to coaches really, maybe this is just, how coaches like to talk in post games and stuff, but I really feel like at this point in the season, you hear these things all the time, right? One more game, everybody's 0-0. We just got to keep pushing through. It feels like they take a really utilitarian approach to March. You have to keep it really simple, or else, you keep thinking about these scenarios. Oh my God, my effective field goal percentage, like that stuff like that. That's gonna, I like effective field goal percentage. No offense to any of the stat heads out there. But, at this point in the season, if you're thinking about that kind of stuff, you're already left behind. So yeah, a really interesting opportunity for Duquesne. Against Saint Bonaventure tomorrow, how do you feel like things will shake out? Starting off with you, Riley.
Yeah, I mean, you look at Duquesne's defense to begin with. You got Jimmy Clark, Day-Day Grant. Hopefully, they're going to be able to re replace Williams on the inside and find someone who can kind of deal with Venning or Noel Brown, whoever they decide to go with. But I think the Duquesne defense is going to give Saint Bonaventure some problems, particularly if they come out like they did last night and, were to let up something like were to go down by 15 like they did against like Saint Bonaventure did against. Or did the other night. And again, Duquesne, they have a ton of depth, a ton of versatility. They can hit you in so many different ways. And I think that's going to provide Saint Bonaventure a ton of problems. I still think Saint Bonaventure has a ton of depth too. I mean, we can go up and down the roster. I think they played maybe nine different guys last night were getting minutes. I can't I think Cairo Luke maybe only played two or three, so realistically, we'll call it eight different guys who were playing minutes about. But the versatility, if Saint Bonaventure comes out like they did last night, I think Duquesne's defense allows them to run away with it pretty quickly. And, how much is the veteran leadership of this Saint Bonaventure team going to be able to do it, two nights in a row? Are they going to have what it takes to kind of push back in the second half? make another run late if Duquesne's able to kind of hold it down on the interior, and cause some issues on the defensive end, as well as continue scoring like they did the other night throughout the lineup. But St. Bonaventure, Mark Schmidt is always a fantastic coach. We like to say at Mid-Major Madness, and I know throughout A10 Twitter as well, that he's always doing more with less. So you can never count them out, truly. And I think I like what David said, that I feel like Duquesne might be the team to beat now, just with the performance they put in last night and the game planning they did against Dayton. But again, you can never count St. Bonaventure out. They're always going to give you a game. And I think, especially after what we saw last night, they're always going to be in it.
And I think something to consider as well is they've already played twice this season. Duquesne's won both of those. And so it's really hard to beat a team three times. And so I'm not going to say it's good, it's the difference maker, but I think it's something to consider. These teams know each other really well. I think there's sort of a budding, there's sort of a rivalry there going. I don't think they like each other too much. And so I think that'll be a really fun one to watch, and it'll be physical. There'll be a lot of depth. I'm very that's the game I think I more have circled tomorrow, the 3:31.
Yeah, and just closing out, Dayton has, obviously they're out of this tournament, but the consensus is once again that they've got more games to play. I feel like everyone kind of feels like they are going to be an at-large team out of the A10. But these next couple days I feel like are going to be a bit anxious for Dayton fans, for the team. How do you feel like the Flyers faithful can, and as well as the Flyers themselves, can kind of take from their season and give them the confidence that that they can get, picked on Selection Sunday?
They're a tournament team. I don't think they really need to be nervous. I think they took care of business in the non-con. I think Daron Holmes has asserted himself as sort of a big enough player. I think this sounds silly, but like the selection committee, like Daron Holmes is in all these like finalists for player of the year, center, all this stuff. Like I think they have become a big enough national story, a national team that's been in the national discussion all year, that they had locked up their fate as a NCAA tournament team by February, I really think. Like, unless things really went catastrophically wrong, Holmes gets hurt, he's out for the season, something like that. They knew they were going to be playing, and pretty much worst case scenario, I think, has happened. And I still think they're a team that will be playing in March Madness. There were talks of them being almost, I think I saw them as high as three in some brackets at some points during the year. I think now they'll be more like 9 or 10, which is a pretty steep drop off from there. But I think they're still safely in the 64 teams.
Yeah, I think I'd have to agree with David, Sam. They're pretty much a lock at this point. I'm certainly no bracketologist like fellow St. Joe's grad Joe Lenardi, but I mean, you look at all the stats and all the different, selection people who are doing their own bracketology reports, and it looks like Dayton's pretty much a lock. I think they locked it up with the way they played, particularly in the non-conference with a couple big wins. I know they didn't necessarily dominate the A10 this year, but I think their resume is still good enough where, like David said, they're going to be somewhere around 8, 9, 10 maybe. Obviously, the loss hurts, and it's going to hurt their seeding, and most likely puts them outside the national rankings. Having been the 25th ranked team kind of heading into this week, but yeah, I don't think Flyer fans are going to have to worry too much. I think the focus should more so be how do we rebound from this loss, to have a more successful performance in the tournament for against whoever we're going to be, matched up against.
Yeah, I agree. Their non-conference was really solid. I feel like that win against St. John's was definitely one of the highlights.
Looking better. St. John's, I
Yeah.
mean, they've been playing well. The shame of not being live right now is we're tracking the St. John's UConn game as we're recording this, and something could be happening.
They're down 5 to UConn at half as of recording. So we'll see. I think Dayton fans should definitely be watching that game. St. John's also, people are saying, after their win against Seton Hall, if we can go outside the A10 a little bit, St. John's has pretty much clinched an at-large bid with that win against Seton Hall. Obviously, as Dayton coach Anthony Grant said last night, nothing's guaranteed, but I think there should be, some comfort in the Johnnies this week for Flyers fans. Any other thoughts this week from this week in the A10 tournament?
Yeah, I'd like to pose a quick question here. While we're on the topic of the tournament, where do you think the A10 champion of the four remaining teams, what do you think their seed will be? Because
Man.
I think it's because they're going to be the automatic qualifiers, so they'll be below 11. Like, will they just be I just think it's a really interesting conversation. Like, are they going to reward them for their big wins in the tournament, or like how low do you think they could be? Because it's interesting. It's a really fun thought exercise.
To cite like a recent, the last time the A10 was a two-bid league, which was in 2022. Richmond, I believe, was the 12 seed when they took down Iowa in the first round. So I think putting the A10 champ at a 12 seed would be really fun. Obviously, there's a lot of superstition and speculation around the success of 12 seeds in the first round of the A10 tournament. So I think it would be really fun to watch an A10 team enter that spoiler role. But I think anything from like a 10 to 13 would be a pretty fair fit for this eventual A10 champ.
I
And I
think
think.
if it shows, I think they could be low. I think they have too many bad losses. I think the committee could put them as low as a 14 if St. Joe's is the one that makes it, which I think would be a pretty tall task for them. But on the flip side, how terrified are you if you're a three and you have to go up against St. Joe's, who eat Richmond, who would beat another really great team on the way here and has played Kentucky down to the wire, rough, beat Villanova. Like, what would they be like? It's just so interesting to look at these because I think all these teams are really good, but they are also all deeply flawed. And I really don't know how the committee would view one of these as the A10 champs.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to sound like a St. Joe's homer. I know I am the St. Joe's alum currently on the show today, but I disagree with you, David, to that point that I think, St. Joe's would definitely be somewhere lower down there. But I think at the very least, we've got four really interesting resumes that kind of remain out of the groups. St. Joe's is obviously the easiest one for me to look at, but some great wins in the non-conference definitely, are raising some eyebrows. If you're a team that were to come up against a smaller squad like St. Joe's, or an under seat, a lower seated squad like St. Joe's. And I think it's there. We have a couple teams here remaining in A10 play that are going to give the committee a lot to think about, when it comes down to selecting those seeds, particularly with just some of the interesting resumes we have going on. A couple tough losses throughout the rankings, some good wins throughout, and a really interesting thought exercise, as you mentioned, David.
I'm just going to say a few things. I'm going to say three schools that they lost to: Texas A&M Commerce, St. Louis, and Rhode Island.
Absolutely.
I feel like, honestly, especially with the way Villanova has looked lately, I feel like those hold more weight than their wins.
Yeah, I don't think I'd disagree with you necessarily. Particularly, I mean, Villanova might not even, be a bid to this year's NCAA tournament. But again, I still think it just a really interesting resume kind of that for a committee to have to decide where you're going to place. And again, I won't argue with you on them being, if St. Joe's were to qualify out of the A10, out of them being, somewhere around a 14 seed. But I think it's certainly, like you said, David, not a team that a higher seed is going to want to have to put, go up against, knowing that they took Kentucky into overtime. They did beat, a big school, a big program like Villanova on the road. They were able to beat Richmond on a neutral court, in the conference tournament. I just think at the very least, we have some resumes that are going to, scare some teams potentially coming up coming up against a lower seed out of the A10.
Yeah, we're about 48 hours from the selection show, but in that span, we have three fantastic Atlantic 10 championship games on the way. So I think this is going to wrap it up for this special tournament edition of the A10 Talk podcast. Once again, I'm Sam Basil, joined alongside Riley Frayne from Mid-Major Madness, alongside as well as A10 Talk's David Korn. And until then, we'll see you guys next time.